If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Hello and welcome to episode 21 of Pixel Sift. Gianni here, and once again, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Mitch and Scott.
Hey, hey.
Hello.
And boy, do we have a cracker of a show for you today. Starting off, we're going to be looking at tutorials and games. What makes a good tutorial and what makes them too tedious? What is it about how they teach you to play a game that makes it good or bad?
One of the reasons that we were very happy to bring Level 1 from this room here in the State Library to our office is that our office is a space that we've put a lot of work into, and it's an old house, and it's, for me, having a space that feels like, you know, it feels kind of homely and inviting and accessible is really important.
Yeah, that was an interview with Sophie, Louis, and Kate from the Level 1 Co-op Working Space, and they'll be telling us about their organization and how they're helping Perth-based game developers work stuff out.
And finally, we'll talk to the annual release double standard of video games. Why is it okay for some games to only have some minor changes year to year, but others we accuse of repainting the same old thing?
Good question, good question. All that and more on episode 21 of Pixel Sift.
You're listening to Pixel Sift.
Some games, when they come out, are, you know, groundbreaking, very new, innovative. Some games are not. And there is a perception with some games when they come out, if they're a sort of the next chapter in a series, or if they're the next kind of segment of a particular, you know, game franchise, that when they bring out a new release, it's basically reprinting the cartridges and, you know, redoing it completely again. But some game series which do a very similar thing are not accused of the same.
Nintendo.
Hence the double standard. Yeah.
And we're just wondering why that might be, and what is it in those games that we think, you know, this is innovative enough and something that is different enough, even though nominally it is number 7 in a series or something like that.
It's interesting that, like, the different approach we take to different properties. Like, the Call of Duty franchise is something that is accused of this often, and they seem to catch a lot of flack for just releasing the same thing every year. But, like, with a few different guns and a few different maybe story elements. But then there are, like, you know, the sports games or like FIFA, which I think personally have looked the same since I first saw one when I was 10. So, well, yeah.
With sports games anyway, I would say, like, soccer or whatever. Like, you know, yearly you've got graphical updates as well as roster updates, you know, all the transfers that happen in the real life. Because it's a real life emulation, basically. So you want to keep up to date with the real life changes to the game, which is, you know, an everyday thing. And let's say with COD, let's just say first-person shooter, like type war sims, I guess, in general, there's not a heavy amount of graphical updates. I mean, with COD, I think they've been using the same Quake 3 engine for, you know, a decade or so. I don't know if that's actually been updated for the new releases, because I haven't sunk time into them, because I haven't really liked them. But, I mean, you buy them for the slight graphical update. But you're buying them for the maps, you're buying them for the guns, you're buying them for the, you know, new survival levels or whatever they've added into it. Like, generally the game doesn't change too much because people like it, you know. It's just
you give people what they want.
It really, I feel like it's just an alternative instead of buying you know, say a huge update, or like, you know, being part of a subscription update service. They just give you a new game every year or so. I mean, in saying that, like, I feel like COD's become a bit of a joke lately. Like, I stopped paying attention to that. And this last one I really liked, I guess, was like Black Ops. But even before that, I mean, Modern Warfare was probably the last one where it was really kind of a huge difference.
I mean, there's an argument as well made for, especially for a lot of these games, which are the annualized sort of releases, and they are pretty much bringing out the same version of the same thing. There is a big following for people who play those online and in multiplayer. And if you have a formula that works, that's kind of been honed and fine-tuned throughout a number of patches and versions like that, you don't want to hugely change that because, you know, if you've got people who are good at the game and you go and change something that, you know, mixes it up completely, you go and alienate a fan base that is already, you know, pretty invested in your game. And maybe it is people who aren't as invested in this game who want to play games. You know, they might jump into the single-player campaign of a Call of Duty game, and for them to see that being sort of rehashed, it's not so much of a, you know, a big difference. Maybe we don't see the subtleties of the differences. And
that's the problem with these kind of games. You're mainly, they're catering for the loyal fans and for, like, you know, the actual kind of the people that are playing it constantly. They will want that new release. For, yeah, your blow-ins that are kind of just playing it and maybe haven't played it for a few years, it might not seem overly different. But, like, say, let's Pokemon. Essentially the same game for the last, you know, almost 20 years now or whatever. 98 was Blue and Red, I think.
Yeah, 20 years tomorrow, pretty much.
Oh, wow.
How topical.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a collecting type game where the new release aims to provide the audience with, you know, new things to collect and catch them all sort of thing.
And the content kind of just adds into that, but the formula stays the same. And,
yeah, exactly.
And you were saying with Nintendo games earlier in the piece.
So I guess basically I think there's like a certain level of consumer, I guess, safety. I think that like people feel that these properties won't really disappoint them because they haven't yet. And then so the companies capitalize on that by creating more of it.
But are they playing it too safe?
Yeah, or are possibly, they ripping you off by doing that kind of thing? You know, just really, that just sounds like cashing in.
It does.
Yeah.
But it is what the consumer, at the end of the day, wants.
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't do it if they didn't sell every time.
Nintendo is a really interesting example of this because they do just about every platform that they bring out, whether it's, you know, GameCube, Wii U, they'll bring out a version of their flagship titles on each of those, and there will be, like, you know, there'll always be a Zelda game, there'll always be a new Mario game, there'll always be a new Mario Kart, and there'll always be, you know, a new Smash Bros. That's kind of the way it works. And, you know, they do add and tweak little bits and pieces, but, you know, they're the main games that people play, and they're the sort of the flagship titles. And
I guess the confusing part is, why is Nintendo often praised for this and then the Call of Duty franchise is demonized for it? I think that's the question that needs to be asked, and I'm actually not sure how to answer that, but yeah.
Well, look, I don't have a problem with annual releases. I more have a problem with the drive behind them. You know, like some games don't call for prolific releases, whereas others, you know, and it shows in the quality and enjoyment that people get out of the game. Like back to first-person shooter, my favorite Battlefield was 3. There's nothing intrinsically different of, like, compared to the other Battlefields or even since then. I liked the maps in that the best. I liked the guns. I liked everything. It was the package in that I thought was the best one that I'd played and enjoyed the most.
When we chatted to Nick McDonald on our last episode, he talked a bit about gamer entitlement and the sort of perception that people have a certain expectation of particular games, and that voice can be very loud and very, you know, quite confronting. I mean, we have these people who complain loudly about these particular things, but maybe, you know, Jane and Joe blogs who play the game and just happily play it are very happy with these particular things, and it's the squeaky wheels who, you know, that maybe don't represent the full picture of the gaming populace.
It's also good to point out that the people that are complaining the most will be the first in line. The new one, I find.
That's true. They were talking about with the Left 4 Dead 2 boycott
when that
came out.
Yeah.
They were the ones they knew that had joined the group, also pre-ordered at a much greater rate.
But that's playing into the obsessive hands, I guess, or like the pure fans. I mean, let's take it out of the gaming realm for a second and talk about iPhones in comparison.
I was just thinking of that.
Well, yeah, because, you know, people love them and line up like crazy for them, and I'm not mixing words, crazy. People go crazy over that, and it's not because they're the best or whatever, it's because they're marketed the best and they're the most appealing, and therefore like praised and sought after.
And probably, you know, there is a consistency in them as well. You know that if you buy one, it's going to be very similar to the previous one, just ever so slightly better. And that's a very similar sort of example for these sort of games.
That's enough for a certain group of people.
Yeah,
sure. Exactly.
If you want a reliability in what you're doing. I think it's something that we have to think about. Why do we let some game companies and publishers get away with doing a very similar thing, but we are also very harsh on other ones.
We do make it happen ourselves.
What's the missing element that we're just kind of missing between the, you know, why does a Nintendo get away with doing, you know, Mario Kart up to 7 now on thing, and then there's Mario Kart Wii U, which is versus, you know, Call of Duty Black Ops 3 or whatever. You know, people, you know, jump on that, or even Assassin's Creed, which has dropped down from its yearly release cycle now to be every other year. But
that spiked up quickly. So Assassin's Creed 3 was like the highest pre-ordered game for Ubisoft at the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, based on that, I can understand why they'd want to push a game out every year. But, that, you know, they do reach critical mass at some point, quality-wise anyway.
It's good to point out that Mario Karts don't come out every year.
That's true. But they do come out every generation.
That's true. Yeah.
And they will be kind of, you know, it'll be evolving from the same sort of thing.
We do use the term annually a bit loosely, I guess, there. Some of those annual releases, some of them are just kind of prolific.
Yeah, but maybe there's not a huge difference between that and the previous one. So, yep. I don't know. It's very, very... I guess it's very fascinating to explore the differences between perceptions of these particular topics and whether we think that something like this is good or bad. It's all in the eye of the beholder.
Did you know Pixel Ziv is available on other platforms? You can find previous episodes on iTunes, Pocket Casts, YouTube, and on the Pixel Ziv website.
If you're a budding game developer, it can be daunting to make the jump from part-time to full-time game development work. A new collaboration between SK Games and the Film and Television Institute aims to provide a venue for game developers to work together and learn from each other. We spoke to the team behind the new co-working space Level 1, and we asked them what a co-working space is and what it means for West Australian game makers.
Well, co-working spaces have been around for maybe 10, 15 years. And what co-working spaces are, basically, if you're working as a freelancer or working in a small team and maybe you're working from home, it can get really isolating and you kind of lose all of the benefits of being in an office. So co-working allows people who are in those situations to come and work together and have the benefit of having other people around just to keep you sane, but also to act as a resource if you need help with something. Also, if it's for a specific industry, which is what ours is for the games industry, it helps to, it shows kind of the vibrancy and it actually makes that visible, because otherwise you have people working at home. So it becomes a place where if someone's interested in investing or finding out more about the games industry, you can just point them and say, come on this day and meet these people. And it's just this really great way of kind of showcasing what's happening and showing that things are really starting to coalesce. So I'm Kate Rains-Goldy. I run the Games and Interactive program at FTI. I also co-run Level 1 with SK Games. And I am a game designer. I make mixed reality games. I've been doing that for about 8 or 9 years.
I'm Louis, Louis Roots. I run SK Games. I've been a developer previously. I think I'm a developer. We mostly host parties, exhibitions, showcase weird alt games and art stuff. We do this in Perth and around the country and actually around the world sometimes.
I'm Sophie. I work alongside Lou to run the SK events and help make and create weird arcade controllers, which is super fun. And at the moment, focusing on our co-working space, which is Level 1.
I really like games co-working spaces because it sort of seems like a more tangible thing to base a co-working space around.
Yeah, so it's something that's definitely lacking in Perth, and it's been talked about for a while. We've just had an opportunity to kind of, you know, start trialing and pushing the idea further. So that's how Level 1 kind of came about, really.
It's really important because they have spaces like this in Melbourne and other places where they have the game-focused ones, and they've been really effective at helping the industry to grow. So we have co-working spaces here like Space Cubed, but they're for the startup scene and not for games. And games folk and games developers have different needs than people in startup the startup world. So we're able to cater to that by having a game-specific co-working space.
Another thing to think about with co-working spaces for game devs is that like it's really not funded very well in WA. So, you know, a lot of the co-working spaces aren't affordable options for game dev. Yeah, so like we're trying to offer something that would, yeah, that can be accessible financially for people that just, you know, need that push to get out of their bedroom and work with other people and learn with other people.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's kind of a joke that going around about people eating tinned tomatoes for dinner. So when you're doing that, you can't really afford $250 a week for a desk at Space Cubed.
So is the aim to kind of push the part-time or hobbyist game dev into semi-pro or professional level?
I'd say we wouldn't really want to push, but I mean, we want to often, I think people are a lot more willing to take the jump when they know that there is places that will support them and other developers who are also doing the same thing. If there was no kind of, you know, it's not like a safety net, it's just a group of people. It's like an AA meeting, but for, you know, people who want to quit regular jobs. So yeah, I think like having that network of physical people, like, you know, because online networks are great as well. And that's a really big part of stuff like for a lot of developers, but I suppose that's not really, you know, we're trying to get the physical side down and the social side.
You know, if you get, it's kind of like what's happened in Melbourne where you have one studio that's done really well, one or two, they can kind of bring everybody else up. So if we can start having that kind of success here as well, because as Soph mentioned, we don't have state level funding from the government like they do in Victoria to fund our games here. So it's very difficult at the early stages when you can't get private investment and you can't sell your game yet or even do early access to get your game to that point. And you really have to sacrifice a lot. So that's where the government can really help out. And so our hope is that also that we can get government funding to make this more sustainable, because right now it's running on kind of the generosity of SK, who are donating the space. And that's the only reason we're able to do it at such a low rate, but it's not sustainable long term.
Can the WA games industry continue on if the funding stays at this level, or are we going to see more of a brain drain to states like Victoria?
We're already seeing that, the brain drain. We did a survey in 2014, and that was a huge issue, is that we have people who are trained really well here, and then they end up leaving because there's no jobs. And so we do have amazing talent here. I mean, SK Games is one of the examples of a great studio that's doing amazing things here, and doing things not just creatively, but supporting the industry, like with stuff like Level One. But the challenge that you have is that people are leaving, and we can't compete because we don't have the same resources. So it's not that stuff isn't happening here, it's not that we're not progressing, it's just that it's going to take longer because we don't have the same kind of access to resources that can accelerate the studios like it has in Victoria.
The Arcade over in Melbourne is probably the most famous and successful gaming co-working space in Australia. Is the plan to work towards something like that for Level One?
Maybe Perth will find its own way and it'll be something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, the Arcade is great. But yeah, obviously it's built around several different companies, and I doubt we'll find the same scale anytime soon. But I suppose what I like about being part of it at this stage is being able to put our own kind of emphasis on games as play and as non-commercial entities that I don't see as much in the Arcade. Our SK events and stuff sort of showcase that as, hey, you can make a game that's just good for a party. And it'll be a good showcase of, hey, look, this is just stuff that you can do over a weekend, and then you can have a really fun party with like a lot of people, and you can see people play your game, and you know, you can just enjoy the act of games without having to worry too much about the business side.
But isn't that a good argument for more funding? We have funding available for films and TV, which have certain local or cultural value that isn't necessarily commercial. Is it disheartening that that sort of funding isn't available to games?
It is incredibly disheartening, yes, all the time. I wish someone would give me some money.
Well, it's an ongoing debate, a discussion that we have where games are not considered art. So there's that really great example where there was the joint Screen Australia and CMF Canadian Media Fund for new innovative interactive pieces that basically defined what a game was and then said no games are allowed. So you have that because games are not considered art by the powers that be. And so you have that as an issue where even if you're creating games as art and not even doing it as a commercial thing, it's still not going to be supported by the arts funding because games are not art, which blows my mind.
That's true. That's true. I think what's interesting with the cross-pollination, though, is like we have experience in trying to get grant funding for game-related projects that I would deem art. And it's like very frustrating, as we mentioned. But what's exciting is that more and more people approach us, like artists or musicians approach us to work on projects with us and collaborate. So I think when there's artists and musicians approaching game developers, I think that says a lot about it probably being art.
Level One will be having their launch event next week on Thursday, the 3rd of March. This launch includes tours from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, so you can go down there and check it out. They're in West Perth. They're also having a small party at night, and that's starting at 5 p.m. It's free and it's open to the public, but you do need to RSVP online. So head over to level1.org.au if you're interested in coming along, and we'll stick a link up to the RSVP page on the notes for this show on our site. Most of Pixel Sift will be down there as well, so you can come say hi if you're checking it out.
Pixel Sift!
It's not Pixel Sieve. It's Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sift!
Every time you play a game, you have to go through a learning curve. And when I used to play games, there was a thick manual that you would read through for many hours beforehand, sometimes many hours afterwards. If you even weren't allowed to play the game, you would get in there and look, check out the manual. And that would be the main way that you'd learn how to play a game. As we've moved to more...
Because you're old.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's brutal. Anyway, manuals, they used to be in games. Heartbroken, just split. Basically now when you're in a game, they have to do most of the training of your play style and the way that you learn how to play a game throughout gameplay in the game. And it's much simpler to sort of provide these opportunities for people to learn how to use particular aspects in a game rather than just throw a key map on the thing or a controller map on top of the piece of paper called a manual where you would go from there.
Well, so basically, I think what makes a good tutorial is I think you need to make sure it's not text-based to start off with, because I think text-based things in video games tend to be skipped pretty heavily by the gamer. So like they won't take notice of it, and they won't learn the appropriate skills that need to be used later, and they won't have those tools to challenge to overcome those challenges.
You don't want to put a book in front of them if they should be.
Absolutely not.
Mm.
Throw out the book.
Yeah,
yeah.
Now, look, there's different types of learners. Some people will work off different tutorials, and other people won't. Some people work off visuals, orally, kinetically, even like so, seeing, hearing, or even just motion. There's also learning by doing, but that's kind of the point of tutorials, to remove that completely.
Yeah.
No one likes tutorials. Even when you don't know what to do, you still don't want to kind of be held back through the vague prompts and menial tasks that they put you through.
For me, the old manual that you used to have with a game seemed to be much more like a throwback to the older style RPG games where people would play like Dungeons or Dragons or whatever, and you'd be like, okay, I have to flick through the book and find out what the particular rule is, and we go look it up like
What's the procedure here?
Yeah, what happens in this particular blah, blah, blah. That seems like more of a throwback, but now that we've got the ability with, high quality video and high quality graphics, we can put more of the user interface elements into the game and teach people as they go and have things pop up as they appear.
See, that's the thing. Like, we've raised up in quality and all the other things, but, tutorials are still pretty painful, and they have been for quite a while. They're the first point of contact with the game, and they can either kind of early on make it or break it for you.
I wish devs spent
a little bit more time on kind of really making them... appealing.
That trap happens when a video game developer tends to develop their tutorial after the game is done.
I feel like there's a constant thing. I mean, you can't do the tutorial for a game that hasn't been properly made and run through.
Well, I think when you developed it, when you develop a tutorial after a game is completely done, I think there's a danger with front-loading too much information onto the player, as in like you tell the player everything they need to know about the game. And suddenly, by the time they've got to the later part of the narrative, and they won't know how to approach it because they were told something at the beginning of the game that they'll need now.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a trap that they could fall into.
Well, I think that's the trick with a good tutorial, is that you set up a few of the basic rules of a game.
Yep.
And you teach them in a way that then if they come across something that they have to do that isn't been spelled out for them, they now have the ability to kind of, you know, take their lessons and build from there.
I like a little prompt, like for say that, you have your proper tutorial where, like, you know, they stop you from doing things and they kind of hold your hand through a few actions, you know.
Wait until you jump over this little crevasse or whatever.
A really good example of that, a game that did it quite well, was Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon. And it takes a little bit of a kinetic stab at the whole tutorial thing by, like, you know, the guy you're actually controlling basically is annoyed by the fact that he has to keep doing this tutorial stuff because it's like it's happening to him as well, which is, you know, great because it only goes for a couple of minutes and it kind of lightens that load of it being a pain in the ass.
I think there's a difference as well between when you have a game where you start a game and then you're given the option, have you played this before? Would you like to just jump in? And that's obviously a tutorial, but then you have other games, for example, like games like Portal, for example, where people, you know, the first half of the game is basically a tutorial, but it's still fun to play through even though you're still learning how to do the mechanics of the game. And
Portal does something very well at the end of every Portal stage. There's at least a level of accomplishment, even from the very beginning where you open the portal and you get congratulated. It's like, I think you need to, you can't just exit the tutorial and you've just learned the skills. You need to have felt like you progressed in the game somehow, and that really disguises the concept.
Gain something from it, you know, get a weapon or whatever. Yeah, that's really good. You get incentive for doing your tutorials, basically.
Well, it's, when you think about it, there's different types of games as well. So, for example, like a game like Portal, where a whole part of it is you're teaching someone to fish and then they learn how to fish at the end. You know, that's the whole point of the game. But then we've got other games where basically the instructions in the games are the game. So, say, for example, like Guitar Hero or Rock Band, where basically you're just following instructions the way through.
That's true.
And part of it is just following the instructions as correctly as possible. And you sort of, that ramps up as well in difficulty as you go through, but you know, the song at the beginning of the game is still going to be fundamentally the same as the song at the end of the game. You just need to do slightly more complex things.
I think one of the best tutorial sequences I've experienced is probably the Borderlands 2 beginning. Like, that whole starting sequence, even the HUD is introduced to you in steps. So, like, you go through, I think you've exposed to maybe your map first and then your health bar. And then as you move through, then you get your shield pretty much at the middle of it, after you've learned how to deal with your health and your weapons and things like that. So I think it just gives it to you in small, understandable chunks.
One that did it really well for me, going back, the original Metroid. It didn't have a tutorial, really. This is back in the, you know, notebook days, but even then, not a huge amount. The thing that really set it apart, which made you realize that things were different, was that you started in the middle of the screen, like facing forwards. This is in the back in the day of, you know, your left, right, side scrollers kind of thing. So the fact that you were in the middle of the screen was like, whoa, I can go any direction.
Yeah.
And you did.
You kind of went in any direction. And as you go through that,
doesn't sound like a huge thing now, but at the time it was, you know.
You come across particular ways, and the way that they do with lots of the Metroid things is they kind of block off certain areas in order to make you sort of funnel you down a path.
But they show something in there and they're like, you can go in here, but just but not the way
not
you
quite
think
yet.
You can.
Just wait. Yeah. Just wait. Come back once you've got the rocket launcher or the something else.
or whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Come back through that way. So
Developers can also capitalize on, like the Metroid thing, like the first, like a concept of the first person shooter is pretty, I guess, the gamers have affordances now that they have understood through years and years of gameplay. So you know what a side scroll is going to look like, you know what a first person shooter is going to look like. So developers can capitalize on that now. So that is one of the reasons why your book has not really appeared.
It's also very cool when they take the rules that have been set up in the previous part of the game and then kind of twist them as well. So, you know, there's games, for example, like Undertale, which is a new game that's kind of come out, and it takes that sort of classic SNES era RPG sort of game, and everything you do in the game has an effect, and everything you know, would normally do in a game, like, for example, it's an RPG, so normally you'd fight everything and you'd have to defeat every enemy, but in that has a concrete effect of what you've actually been doing, so that, you know, they've taken this rule and kind of switched it. And Braid is another example by Jonathan Blow as well. It starts out looking like it's a very simple sort of platformer, but as you go through the game, the mechanics kind of switch around and they just move in a pace that, you know, keeps it interesting and kind of changes the way that, you know, you play the game.
On a note, that games that I think do it poorly, I've recently started playing Civilization for, I know, but the first time in a long time, you know, I haven't played forever, and I'm no stranger to strategy games, but I thought I'd, you know, do the right thing and do the tutorials, and too narrow, too long, like, I lost my steam and excitement of playing a strategy game so quickly, and I didn't even play a real game. Ridiculous.
Could have spent hours.
I should have just jumped in.
I knew
I should have just jumped in and just, like, dealt with it, but I didn't, and it killed me.
Well, we're all learning things, and now we're learning that this is the end of the episode.
Yeah, so, for a podcast creation tutorial.
Yeah.
We're going to post that later.
Yeah, exactly right. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Pixel Sift. We hope you've enjoyed the show. As usual, we'll be putting links up on our website, which is www.pixelsift.com.au. And Scott, if people are going on social media, where can they go to find us?
People, you can find us on facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsift, twitch.tv/pixelsift, and youtube.com/pixelsiftau, just and to mix it up a bit.
That's right, just for a little bit of variety in there.
Keep you on your toes.
Mitch, if people want to listen to our other episodes, where should they be going?
Yeah, so you can go to our website to stream the episodes, or subscribe to us on iTunes or Pocket Cast, or use the RSS link on our page.
And if you're on iTunes, give us a rating or a review. Maybe recommend us to a friend. We really appreciate it. It also helps us do better at the show, makes us more, you know, gives us more resources. And it's always fantastic for people to have a listen and give us your feedback as well.
Yeah, my ego could use a boost.
Yeah, get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. We've also got a Steam group, so jump on there as well.
Seriously, how do you join that?
You have to teach a man to fish.
Yeah.
Catch you later.
I need a tutorial on Steam groups.
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.